It's the 15th of November, 2006. Interviewer is Michael McHugh for Discovery Museum for the Punk 76 exhibition. If I state your name, please.
My name is Tim Jones.
And can you tell us a bit about when and where you were born, Tim?
I was actually born in Billinge Hospital in Wigan on the 1st of February 1958. And then shortly after, we moved to St Helens, which is like a suburb of Liverpool, really. And I lived there till I was 8. And then after that, we generally followed, the family followed me dad about wherever my dad was working. He was an industrial chemist and he worked abroad a lot. But he would work with companies that were based in the UK, so we'd have to go wherever the companies were based. So we ended up in Dundee in Scotland when I was 8. I lived there till I was 14 and then came down to Durham. My dad worked in South Shields for a company in South Shields, but we moved to Durham to live, and I went to school there until I finished school, really.
Do you have any brothers and sisters?
Yeah, I've got two brothers, Christopher and Jonathan. Christopher's 10 years younger than me. I'm 48 right now, so he's just about to hit his 40th birthday. And my youngest brother, Jonathan, is 39.
So what age did you move to whereabouts in County Durham?
Sorry, he's not 39. He's a lot younger than me.
Whereabouts in County Durham did you move to?
To Durham City. We lived there. And then the thing is, usually children leave their families, but my family left me. They went to live in Africa because my dad was working there. And it was the first time that my mother actually went with him to work. I mean, sometimes, for instance, he worked in Argentina for 18 months and we never even saw him at Christmas, you know. So I didn't see a lot of my dad when I was a kid. Which is probably a lot to do with half of my problems.
What did your mother do?
My mother was a chemist as well. That's how they met. They were both industrial chemists. Yeah.
Can you tell us a bit about your schools that you went to?
Yeah, this is really interesting. In Scotland, the school I went to was called the Grove Academy in Dundee. I say Dundee, it was called Broughty Ferry, which is like a suburb of Dundee. And it was a brilliant school. We even had a school committee that you could take if you had a problem. You could go and speak to them, and so it was a very free, open education. Problem was, when we moved back down to England and I moved to Durham, I went to a grammar school. I got into grammar school, and that was hell, absolutely hell, and it virtually wrote me off at 16.
What do you mean wrote you off?
Well, literally. Became the pressure of it was a lot. It was a lot of pressure, and my father very much believed in education, I was used to a free education system. I found the English education system far too strict. I thought that the headmaster, Mr. Bagley, was like Goebbels, or no, Hitler, and the deputy head was more like Goebbels. I'd never even seen, we did sort of experimental maths and stuff in the school in Scotland. When I came down here, I'd never even seen a set of logarithm tables. And there was just a lot of pressure. So I nearly died. And I ended up having my stomach pumped out in Dryburn Hospital. So I left home and joined the band.
Okay. And tell us a bit more about joining a band. Was that in Durham?
Playing the guitar, because of all my self-respect going through the floor and having very little self-respect for myself at that age, because I needed help after the event that I've told you about. And playing guitar gave me the self-respect, and it gave me something to believe in. Finding music was absolutely vital, fundamental for my existence.
What kind of music?
Well, at that time, this was before punk. So you're talking sort of 1972 through 76. So it was basically rock music. that punk didn't exist as a concept. So we were, you know, guitar, bass and drums type rock, you know.
What sort of bands were we listening to?
Ooh, all kinds of things. I love Captain Beefheart. I always liked him early on. And even things, I haven't got my woolly hat on, but Steve Hillage and Gong and a lot of sort of, I suppose, Canterbury type music, Caravan, Soft Machine, that kind of thing. I mean, it's quintessentially English, really, you know. But when I was a kid, Black Sabbath, Led Zeppelin, you know, all of those. But even that, we used to call what is now called heavy metal, or what was called heavy metal later, we used to call that progressive music. Led Zeppelin we called progressive. Jethro Tull were progressive. You know, hairy music. And Hawkwind, I mean, I saw Hawkwind at the Cade Hall in Dundee in 1971. And only three of the band were on stage because the rest of them had been arrested and were being detained at the police station. I saw Yes for 60 pence at the Cade Hall. I queued up from 6 o'clock in the morning until 10 o'clock to get a ticket. All the tickets were £1 for Led Zeppelin. And I got a ticket, and that was absolutely magical. I mean, it was like a religious experience seeing them. Even the PA columns were dancing.
Where was that again?
At the Cade Hall in Dundee. It's like the equivalent of Newcastle City Hall, I suppose, really.
Could you tell us a bit more about forming a band and who that was?
Yeah, well, there I was. I mean, you know, a lot of people would try to sort of smooth over the cracks or whatever, but that changed at 16, where I made the choice to sort of leave home and join a band. Some people they wouldn't want to mention things like suicide, you know. But I had a lot of problems. You look back now. If I saw the kid, if the kid that I was then at 16 walked into this room, I'd probably want to beat them up. You know, people change. I'm a great believer in that. People do change, and people don't like you to change very much because they like to keep their reference points. They like you to be just as you were, you know, so that you can be a reference to them. So what was your question?
It was about forming a band. Who you
there I was. I was actually sitting in the county hospital in Durham, and a guy I'd known from school called Paddy, who was a drummer, phenomenal drummer. He came to see me, and I didn't really know Paddy that well, really. And he said, "Hey, I tell you what, I've got a cure. Why don't you come and join a band with us in Middlesbrough?" This was called Eyes to the Sky, and he gave me a tape. So I listened to the tape, and I said, "Yeah." So I just went, and I lived in a caravan in Middlesbrough, and then there was a guy that worked for British Steel called Oz, who looked a bit like a Viking, and he was actually, he made swords, Viking swords, at British Steel in his spare time. And he had a house, and he sublet it to us all, and there were seven of us living in this small house in Middlesbrough. And
what year was this?
This was 1974. Interesting thing about that, there was all kinds of interesting characters in this, all sort of lost kids that had run away from home. One of them, for example, was a guy called Christopher Wade Evans. It was Wevens, who became very, very important with Neon, the band, because he was the sound engineer, and he was a whiz kid with electronics, purely self-taught. Wevens works with the Rolling Stones to this day. He's their on-stage sound technician. I mean, mention anybody, Wevens, to anybody in that sort of business, they'll know who he is. He's worked with, you know, Santana, Bob Dylan, loads and loads of people. Now, Wevens, his father kind of disowned him when he was 14, and he'd lived from hand to mouth. They ended up in the same house that I was living in. Paddy, the guy that I mentioned, the drummer, after Neon, both Paddy and Wevens went to London. That's where they got into that sort of mainstream business. And Paddy also, Wevens got the job first, and then got Paddy in, and they built PAs for, like I say, Santana, Dylan. Paddy worked with Peter Gabriel for a long time. And so as technicians, not musicians. They were far more successful as technicians than musicians.
So you, at this point in Middlesbrough, you you'd formed a band.
Yeah, we'd formed a band.
With your friend, and who else was in the band?
Right, there was a guy called Dieter Hubbard, and his parents were quite wealthy, and he lived down the road near this place in Marton in Middlesbrough where we lived. We lived in 42 Farringdon Drive in Middlesbrough. And we used to rehearse in Dieter's house. And this is getting very convoluted. In a place called Great Ayton, which is outside of Middlesbrough, there was a school there, a Quaker school, called the Friends School. And there was a lot of kids there who had, I suppose you would call them, a lot of problems, a lot of behavioural problems and this, that and the other. Anyway, Paddy, the drummer I've mentioned, Dieter, who was the other guitarist, and a guy called Dominic Griffiths, who was the bass player, they were all at the Friends School. And so we used to go and visit the Friends School, and the band came out of there, moved into Dieter's house to rehearse, and then we just started gigging. We were very young, though, you know, I mean, Dieter was only 14, 15.
Where did you come up with the band? You called yourselves Neon at this point?
No, this was Eyes to the Sky. This was before that. It's a long history, okay. And we played gigs at sort of colleges and stuff around Middlesbrough. Anyway, that broke up, the house broke up. Oz actually went a bit loopy for a while. He was older than us, and he kind of looked after us like a, you know, because we were just a bunch of kids. And at parties there, he used to stand with his sword, his Viking sword, you know, at the door and not let anybody in who was too dodgy. But so then we kind of, it became very fragmented. We split up. I went back to Durham and Paddy moved to Scotland to join a band called Dragon. And Dragon did quite well. They won some competition for the Daily Mail, and they the winners got free studio time and a single made.
You're playing quite what you would describe as progressive rock.
Yeah, it was, yeah, I suppose, progressive, a bunch of kids sort of trying to sort out the world, complaining about everything that was wrong with the world, you know, anti-war songs and all this kind of thing, and what it was like to be a kid at that time. I mean, it was a peculiar time, you know, it was like another planet then. I mean, there were no mobile phones or anything then. There was no television stopped at 11:30. You know, there was only BBC and ITV, with two stations, and then eventually BBC Two. I remember the first day we got a colour television set. You know, it was records then, no CDs or anything like that, you know. Cassettes were bloody revolutionary then.
Can you tell us a bit, maybe jump into how Neon came about as a band?
Yeah, so what happened was, I moved back to Durham, and I met up with an old friend from the Johnson School called Mark Dunn. And Mark Dunn was a bass player, and we found a drummer called Paul Taylor, who actually was, his parents lived in Chester Street, but he was in school down south somewhere. I can't quite remember where it was. He was like a boarder at school down there. And we formed this band called Whippet, which was definitely woolly hat music, you know.
This progressive
rock. Yeah. More Steve Village and this kind of thing. And we played quite a few gigs. We did Mayday gigs at the Guildhall in Newcastle and colleges, and we even played an old folks home, which was, that was bizarre, but they enjoyed it. Strange, I suppose, it got so little entertainment, but so it was really weird, you know, playing to all these old folks in wheelchairs and stuff, you know, and 100 watt amplifiers and drum kits and that. But so we'd formed this band and called Whippet, and there was an Irish guy who was at Newcastle, Polly it was at the time, called Don, Irish Don, and he took over on the other guitar. So we had two guitarists, bass and drums. So Paddy came back from Scotland with Wevens, because Wevens had gone to Scotland with Paddy. And Paddy heard Whippet and thought it was really, you know, very woolly hatty type music. And
what year is this?
This was sort of 75 76. Now Paddy at this point was a phenomenal sort of thrashy, technically very competent drummer. He was very strict, Paddy, as well, But being a drummer and behind the kit, he wanted things really tight and everything. So we decided, right, okay, let's have a go with Paddy. So we set up in Paddy's bedroom in Shincliffe, which is a village outside of Durham. And Paddy's father was a music teacher, and they were a Quaker family, and they were very, very understanding. And they let us play with 100-watt amplifiers and stuff in his bedroom. So then there was at Dunelm House, Durham University, their events place, Dunelm House. They were having a competition for local bands, a sort of battle of the bands thing. Well, we hadn't done a gig, but Mark put in an application form, and so we did this gig. And what we did was we got a whole box full of clothes and stuff, of old suits and things like this, and just wore this. And it was from that gig that we got labelled punk. So this must have been just 76 when it happened. And we were thinking punk. You know, because people hadn't really caught on to what it was yet.
You
know,
do you understand what that term meant?
Yeah. So kind of, I mean, remember when The Clash came up and everybody went to see The Clash. And there was a particular tour with, I think it was the Sex Pistols, the Damned and the Buzzcocks, a sort of package tour.
1976.
And so people started cottoning on. So, and I always remember the front of the NME with John Lydon, Johnny Rotten. There was this picture, and me and Paddy looked at it, and we looked into his eyes, and we actually said, there's a lot to that guy. You know, there's something in his eyes that, and of course, it's history now. You know, you knew he was good. This guy was going to be sort of gigantic, you know, and he was.
How did you feel about, like, at that time, punk's emerging? But you've just talked about kind of your woolly hat, aggressive rock.
And it was peculiar.
Quite against the a kind of punk mentality is kind of quite against that. So how did you?
Well, you see, this is the thing that subsequently in the years since then, it all melds together, because you know David Allen from Gong was doing Floating Anarchy tour, and that was in the 70s, late 70s. Hawkwind always crossed over. You'll find a lot of punk fans were going to Hawkwind gigs and stuff, you know, and things like alternative TV and the Here and Now. Their ethic was very punk, you know, like Crass Records. I mean, some of the people I played in bands with belonged to Crass Records. Penny Rimbaugh, I think. Yeah, and in fact, I played with a keyboard player called Paul Ellis, who he played on an album called Christ, the album, not a great album. So really, it all sort of melded together. But the problem was initially with punk, you had to be punk, where people would spit at you and you would spit at them, and you had to jump up and down, and everybody, you know, people had to flake out in the audience and stuff and get dragged out and all this kind of thing. A lot of violence, and that's what it was. So it was a bit bewildering. You know, some gigs, like when we got signed to a record company, we would go down to London and do the Nashville or somewhere. And depending on where you would play, sometimes you would literally be confronted by a wall of bottles, anything that they could throw at you, because they would decide you weren't punk. But other places, they would decide you were punk. So, you know, it became very, very... elitist. I mean, imagine that, you know, punk elite being elitist. But it was, it could be.
So when you said about very punk before, what does very punk mean to you?
Very, very punk to me would be the Pistols. I would say they were, they're the epitome of punk, really, aren't they?
Why?
Because picture Sid Vicious standing there at some of those gigs in America, covered in blood, you know, John Lydon dodging things that had been thrown at him. I mean, UK Subs, for instance, Wevans, the guy I mentioned, he toured with the UK Subs, doing sound again. The drummer for the UK Subs got hepatitis through people gobbing on him, you know, and he became sort of very ill. His cymbals at the end of a tour were green because of the gob. If a bouncer came on stage at any point, he would just be covered in gob, you know. They by the end of one particular tour, Wevens was telling me they had one vocal microphone left, and it was one of the last gigs of the tour, and one of the fans nicked it off the mic stand. So Wevens came to the front of the stage. He said, "If we don't get the mic back right now, the band aren't coming on." This SM58 comes flying over the top, like a poof onto the stage, you know. They would do things. I'm talking about very punk here, so to talk about the UK subs.
Your definition of punk.
Yeah, my definition. For instance, the vans would break down. They wouldn't last very long, so they would get a hire car. And then the hire car would break down in the middle of the motorway or dual carriageway. They'd just leave it there and then just, you know, hitch a lift or whatever. Roadies living in bass bins, literally sleeping in bass bins, going from gig to gig. You know, some punk roadies became famous for that just because of the kind of lifestyle that they led, you know. Politically, I think that the business, the mainstream music business and major record companies were out to get punk from the start. It was far too revolutionary. It threatened them. It threatened the order. It threatened everything that they like to preserve, and they still preserve.
Did that appeal to you as a band at that time? That mentality?
Oh, absolutely. And it still does, yeah. Yeah.
So when did you become Neon?
Right.
You did this
gig. We did the gig and we needed a name. So it was Paddy actually that came up with the name Neon. You know, all that sort of... Neon became a kind of popular word because there was the Neon Hearts, Neo. So actually, that was an amusing aside. We went to play the Music Machine in London, and they had a thing in neon lights outside, you know, the name of the band that was on. And what happened was it was meant to be Neon, but the N fell off the end and it said Neo. Well, there was a band called Neo. And the other guitarist, Martin Holder, who joined us by this time, there was some groupies there that had gone to see Neo. And they thought he was the guitarist for Neo. And when they found out it was Neon, they weren't interested at all. You know. Sorry.
So how did you feel about being labelled as punk then?
It was good and bad, because we would get attacked often. We had the van pushed over at Sunderland Poly. Wevens was actually knocked unconscious at one gig in Durham with a pint glass, you know, the glasses with the handle on. And he was just hit over the head with one of them. And he just, you know, in the middle of the place. Place went up. I was watching. I turned around and I thought, this guy's going to punch me in the face. And just before his fist hit me, one of the bouncers grabbed him and just threw him down the flight of stairs, you know. There was a gig at the Guildhall for May Day, which was organised by a wonderful guy called Phil Sutcliffe, who had an awful lot to do with the whole Newcastle scene. He was helping promote that gig. And
what year was this then?
This was 19. This would be 77, I think.
So you'd been gigging a lot of this.
Yeah,
gig,
yeah.
As
yeah.
Neon.
Yeah, you see, this was the thing with punk. Gigs were everywhere. Places like the Bridge Hotel in Newcastle, they were fantastic. You know, the tiny little rooms, really sweaty and hot and stuff. And, you know, I think I was saying, people, you never seem to get asked to turn down. You know, you could just go into small places and play horrendously loud, but that's what people wanted. But this gig at the Guildhall, this was the epitome of the times and why it was good and bad at the same time. The bill was Punishment Luxury, The Angelic Upstarts and Neon. And what happened was, all of a sudden, it had been quite quiet, and then the Upstarts fans turned up. And they were like an army. They were dressed like an army, and they seemed to act like an army. You know, they were all very close-knit.
How were they dressed?
Very violent. Sort of black, bother-booted skinheads. And black clothes, you know. And Menzie was there dancing with a pig's head on the stage, and some of the fans were dressed up as policemen, and they were dancing on the stage and stuff. Anyway, Next thing that happens, we're playing on stage. The Upstarts had been on. They went, I think they were on first. And if I was to describe their stage, they had the stage at right angles to each other. So they had two stages in one corner of the Guildhall. And all of a sudden, our stage was sort of upper height, and I could see on above people's heads. And I'm playing, standing there. And all of a sudden, there's chairs bouncing off people's heads, bottles bouncing off people's heads, stuff smashing off the wall, beer pouring down the walls and stuff. Phil Sutcliffe runs up, says, "Get off stage now, get off stage, you know, it's had it." So I turn around to put the guitar down, walk sort of stage left or right or whatever, and just turn around and I see the PA stacks just straight into the audience, on top of the audience, right? And then I look, and to my right, I see Mark, our bass player, pulling a girl out of the audience who was kicked to hell. You know, she was just covered in blood, really badly beaten up. Pulled her onto the stage. I look to my mic stand, and just below my mic stand, a pool of blood. You know, I'm thinking, where's the police? There's loads of police cars outside. There's no policemen in the Guildhall. They're just like, it's contained, you know. Wait till it's over and come in and clear up the mess. So, blood everywhere, people kicked to hell. So, you can see what I mean. I mean, is that good or is that bad? Now, to me, that's bad.
Why was it a good? Why was it a good gig then? You said it was good and bad. Why was
good and bad? Because people like Phil Sutcliffe were trying to draw bands together into a movement. You know, Punishment Luxury were amazing. You know, Punishment Luxury were one of the most underrated bands that the UK has ever produced, as far as I'm concerned. Neville Luxury was a genius, a real innovator. You know, and people like Punishment Luxury were destroyed by major record companies. You know, they would sign them to record contracts for years, and then get them to record an album which they would never release. And the reason for that would be because it was too political. You know, it was too, sorry, this is far too political. So well, can we do something with it? No, you can't, because we own it. I mean, later on, think about bands like XTC and Virgin. You know, how they were stopped from working for something like 9 years. You know, talk to Pauline about Penetration and what happened to them when they went to America, and then when they tried to get out of their record contract. You know, that's what I'm saying about the business. It was, for instance, shortly after, this would have been 79, because I joined Punishment Luxury eventually after Neon. I only did one tour with them. But before joining Punishment Luxury, I was in Brian Bond's band. Brian Bond was the singer of Punishment Luxury. When he left Punishment Luxury, I joined his band. He was signed to Screen Gems EMI, which was EMI Publishing. And the guy that was looking after Brian's interest was a guy called Phil Sharp. He had discovered Adamant. Now, if you think about Adamant and all the clothes he wore and all of this kind of thing and the regalia and everything else, you would think these people were quite sort of wacky and stuff, you know. If I tried to wear a pink trilby on stage, you watch them stop me from doing, "I like your hat, dear." You know, and take the piss out of you all day. Yeah. Take the piss out of you all day because they don't like that. You know, you don't wear that, you wear this. So where's the punk ethic there? So imagine if you are, if you really have a big following and you're with a major record company and they don't like what you're saying. Now, Neville Luxury, I know for sure that it tilted Nev for a long time. He felt so ripped off by major record companies. They owed him thousands of pounds.
A lot, you know, of bands on the time have they talk about a similar experience.
Yeah. Well, us, Neon. That's what happened with us. Tax loss. You know, we ended up with Radar Records. They've got, you know, they need bands to fail as well as succeed.
What do you mean by that, tax loss?
Well, because they've got to have, you know, they have to consider their overheads and their profits and their, you know, everything to do with the business. They can't have every band a success. You know, so they can always write off the losses against successful artists. You know, I have an awful lot of respect for people like Elvis Costello. When I hear Elvis Costello speaking now, I think he's one of the only people in the business that's actually telling it like it is, or speaking out about any particular issue. So how the hell, I mean, Elvis Costello was so popular and could cross over into that mainstream and come out with songs that were, you know, not so overtly political, I suppose. But we who the hell were we compared to Elvis Costello, you know, the fly, the swat, you know what I mean?
Could you tell us a bit about getting released and you were gigging a lot around the Northeast,
yeah,
outside of the Northeast as well?
Yeah, yeah. Well, the thing is, there we were, because of the commitment to the band, if we weren't rehearsing, we were gigging or we were travelling to gigs. They'd come up with, when we signed to a record company, we were with a small label at first called Sensible Records in Edinburgh.
Which How did that come about?
Right. I haven't told you the bit before. Paul Taylor, who was the drummer for Whip It, the Woolly Hat Band, he became Neon's manager. And he was actually very good at it, much better than he was at drums. And Paul would tell you that, because as a drummer, he was pretty crap. But as a manager, he was very good. So he would knock on people's doors until they couldn't ignore him anymore. And if that wasn't any good, he'd climb through the windows and, you know, just generally get people to listen to the band, take tapes in and get people to come and see the band. You needed characters like that to draw. The business expects that. They don't want to talk to musicians. They want to talk to managers. They want to talk to money people. You know, they don't want to talk to musicians. I mean, this is half of the problem that's made, is that kids in young bands that get signed to record companies, they think that the record companies care about them. This is bullshit. The record companies don't care about them. It's just what they can produce and how much money they can make out of them. That was always the case. Same with punk. So, what was the question? It was about
getting released first.
Yeah, getting released. So,
Sensible Records.
Right. Paul actually managed to get this guy, Lenny Love, down from Edinburgh and Sensible Records to a gig in Newcastle. And Lenny liked the band and decided that he would produce a single. And this was pivotal. This was very, very important, actually, because this led to John Peel and everything else. Lenny put us into a studio in Durham, actually, called Guardian Studios. And I think Terry ran it. He's now dead. Terry was a lovely guy. And a lot of stuff was recorded at Guardian. A lot of the punk stuff was recorded at Guardian Studios. It was basically three pebble-dashed terraced houses that he'd knocked through into one in Framblegate Moor, just outside of Durham. He claimed it was haunted as well. Where was I? Yeah. Sensible Records had released Sad Cafe's first single, I think it was, and then the Rizzillos. They were the Rizzillos.
Sensible and independent record,
yeah,
label.
Yeah, it was independent. So Lenny produced an EP of Neon, which he released on Sensible Records, which was a three-track EP, I'm Only Little, Anytime, Anyplace, Anywhere, and what was the other one? Bottles. And Lenny had contacts and got it to John Peel. And John Peel played it a lot. And that was the first...
Can you explain about John Peel?
Well, John Peel, it wasn't just punk that John Peel was so important. I mean, John Peel was important from day one, all the way back to his original programs in the 60s when he was doing psychedelia, when he was doing progressive and all of that kind of music. If it wasn't for John Peel, half of the bands wouldn't have had records out. The guy was ultimately important. I mean, those John Peel sessions, he could literally make a band. John Peel could pull a band out of nowhere and make them a success, really, you know, getting major airplay. I mean, the bands would give their right teeth to get that kind of exposure now. You know, who's going to replace John Peel? And he was a lovely guy, a human being, who was just, really into music. He would ring you up. You know, you would write to him and he would just ring you up and say, hiya, you know, I can't find your record. What kind of envelope was it in? We were one of countless unknown bands. And yet he would take the time to go and ring you up, you know. He rang up years later. We were still sending him records years later, and he would still ring you up, you know, leave a message.
So the Sensible Records, was that just a one deal?
Yeah, yeah, it was. But through the John Peel sessions, this This was the big change. That's when major record companies started to get interested, and a guy called Martin Rushent. Martin Rushent was the producer for The Stranglers and later The Human League. And he was kind of like a very successful at that point. And he was going to start a record label called Genetics. Martin's dead now. That's the last I heard. He's dead. A lot of these people are dead. Lenny's still alive, I know that. But so Genetics was going to be a subsidiary of Radar Records, which was probably a subsidiary of somebody else. I can't remember who it was. And so the record that we would do with Martin Rushent would come out on Radar Records, even though it was with his production company, Genetics. So all of a sudden, these young kids from Durham get thrown into the Manor in Oxfordshire, which was Virgin's huge sort of mansion in the middle of Oxfordshire.
So it was a subsidiary of Virgin Records? Or
no, no, the Virgin were just the company that owned the studio that we were recording.
So were Radar attached to any kind of major label?
Yeah, Warner Brothers. Right. I think Warner's was the main one, yeah. Yeah, they were ultimately a subsidiary of Warner's. So, they've got go-kart tracks, huge long tables where, you know, made out of one tree where you can't see the end of it and stuff, you know, banquet tables and all of this. Rooms that I couldn't possibly sleep in because they were far too quiet, big four-poster beds and stuff. And, you know, you're thrust into this world and you've got nothing. You know, you got holes in your shoes and stuff, you know, and record companies will do this. So when we get these, all of a sudden we're getting agencies as well, so that would organise gigs for us all over the country. We're on the dole, you know, but you've got to get to all these gigs. So
what year was this then?
This was 77 now, 77, early 78 we're getting into, yeah, because it was 78 was the date on the second Neon single. Anyway, so we've got real problems logistically. The PA's falling apart. The van is just about staying on the road. We've got no money. And we're expected to do all these gigs. So Paul sorts out a meeting with Mr. Rushent at AdVision Studios in London, where Martin Rushent is mixing the new XTC single, which is Are You Receiving Me? I remember that really well. We walk in, explain the situation. Martin Rushent turns around and says, "Don't give me your problems. That's the answer you get. You got a problem? I don't want to hear about it. You've got this gig. You turn up to this gig here. You've got one in Bradford, one in London, one in West of Scotland Agricultural College or something. You know what I mean?"
What if you didn't turn up for these gigs then?
Well, then you'd be in breach of contract.
You'd sign a contract,
you know, because then you would be in deep shit, because the venue would play holy hell, you know, especially if it was a students' union or something, you know what I mean? They've got like loads of people waiting to see. They're not particularly bothered whether it was Neon or not, but you know, that's the entertainment for the night, you know.
You'd sign the contract with Radar as well, and then
yeah. So you have to be very careful because they own everything. They own your toenails, your socks, you know, your underpants and everything until you're like 90, you know.
So you weren't happy with this situation?
No. How to destroy music, how to destroy a band, you know, how to destroy your peace of mind. I mean, you're so tired, you know what I mean? And then you've got all this violence that you know you're going to confront. I mean, the other thing was that, like, there'd be places, Sunderland. There was a place in Sunderland called the Old 29, which became, I mean, it was a well-known venue. It's knocked down now, I think it's a car park. One time we were so, you know, sometimes it could get quite aggressive and there'd usually be a big fight. So we went to see Close Encounters of the Third Kind instead of going to the gig, you know, we just couldn't face it.
Why do you think you were attracted violent? Like, why do you think you were attracted violence at the gigs that you played?
Because the music was very loud, very, very fast, very furious. And you're a nutcase on stage. You know, I mean, sometimes you would think that you were just going to pass out. And you could see yourself from above. And I'd kind of look down and say, oh, I'm playing the guitar, you know, because it was sort of like automatic pilot. And the heat, I mean, we supported Susie and the Banshees one particular gig. This is just a little anecdote. Susie, before that, in the dressing room, we shared the dressing room with
them.
What
year is this?
This would be, I'm trying to think which record they had out. 77, yeah, 77.
This was
a students' union gig. Again, it was, I think, Durham University. She led the band around like a bunch of kids, and she was the leader. And, you know, you don't want to cross her. Susie definitely came across a very, very, very strong character, you know, hard as nails. I don't know whether she was, because I don't know her, but when we shared the dressing room, two of the, I think it was the guitarist and the drummer, or the guitarist and the bassist, I'm not quite sure, they were gay. And they were sort of in this sort of constant embrace in the dressing room. It was a bit off-putting when you're sharing a dressing room with them, you know. So anyway, I gave their roadie, their bus was amazing. The stuff they travel around was an amazing looking thing. Anyway, the roadie, I gave him a neon sticker and he stuck it on his arse, you know. And went round the whole gig. Also, is that a sign of respect, or does he hate us? You know, does he like us? Does he hate us? You know, you can't work that out, really, can you? You use it for toilet paper. But anyway, she was literally, somebody would try and get on the stage, and she had these high-heeled, sort of pointy shoes on, and she was booting them off the stage, you know, literally kicking them off the stage. And big blokes as well, sometimes, you know. And I was just watching people pass out. Buff, down, 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 down in the audience. You know, they had an ambulance, they had people getting dragged out unconscious and stuff. You know, not violence, just people too packed together and too hot an atmosphere, and it could get very, very, and when people are playing at that volume, you know, it's intense.
Why do you think there was such an emergence of bands, like, within the Northeast? Well, you know, things that you've been going to gigs before 76. Why are things different in this period?
That's a very, very interesting question. Because, I mean, if you think about it, think back to the Animals as well. Why were the Animals a huge blues band in the mid-60s in Newcastle, middle of a coal mining district? Why did they make it so big in America and start this English blues explosion? So punk did a similar kind of thing. I mean, a lot of people were very, very successful. I mean, one of the main ones is Sting. I remember Sting playing in a band called Last Exit in Newcastle, which were a jazz rock band, and he had black hair and a big beer belly. You know, so suddenly he's this guy, Sting. You know, Dire Straits, all this kind of thing. I mean, you would say that Penetration were internationally known. I mean, they had an international record deal, and they were, you know, people know them all over the world and stuff. I don't really know. It just kind of, it's like, it was like, I mean, I don't want to sound too hippified here, but it was just like an energy. And you would tap into it. It was just there. It was happening. It was happening so fast that you didn't think about it. You were just a sort of part of it and just felt really, really good about that. There was so much energy about, you know.
What was so from there? Thinking about the Northeast punk scene, like how did it relate to sort of society at the time around the, you know, the kind of gigs you were doing, the music that you were writing, the music that you were listening to? Was there any kind of relationship between life in the Northeast?
Yeah, I would say so. Because, I mean, you know, with the Northeast, you can be, or you could be, certainly. It's different under Blair. I mean, Newcastle has been very much revamped, hasn't it? And rebuilt in a lot of ways. But around that time, there was a hell of a lot of poverty about. I mean, you know, and a hell of a lot of people on the dole. This was long before the bloody poll tax and things like that and all those riots and stuff. You know, people were living on, I remember the dole checks you would get back then would be like £8.25. You know, and that was all you had. I mean, if you smoked, I mean, smoking was a luxury anyway, but you'd make like half an ounce of baccy last year a week. Or you'd try to. There was a lot of poverty. People were very poor. I mean, I was very poor, rock bottom poor, and so were most of the people that I knew, you know. And even, I mean, with Durham being a university town, or Newcastle having a university thing, you get a lot of people who would be passing through, but at the point that they were at university, they were very poor, you know, and then they might go on to get nice jobs and stuff, but they were poor at the time, you know.
So you weren't making, making any kind of living from the band?
We had to, because the only living that we had was the band, because we didn't have time to do anything else, so we were living on nothing. You know, and we didn't eat very well, or, you know, sleep very well, or have very much of anything, really. It was just the band, you know, and the music.
So what kept you going then, your the inspirations music. Of the band?
I suppose stupidly, being young and stupid, because, I mean, I was stupid. You know, I'm not saying that I'm not stupid now, but I was stupid then and knew a lot of stupid people. But I mean, we stupidly believed in stupid record companies. And so they would lead you by the nose, you know, and the various carrots that they would dangle. It's an illusion. It's a mirage, you know. You're not going to get any, you're not going to make any money. You know, this is the record companies make all the money. You know, but the whole thing has changed so much now because I heard a guy from EMI being interviewed recently. He was their A&R department, and he said if he goes to see a band and he thinks this band can sell 120,000 records, EMI can't sign that band because they can't cover their overheads. But why would that said band want to sign to EMI when they can just set up their own website and sell 130,000 records and make all the money themselves? Back then, it wasn't possible. There was no internet. People weren't computer friendly. The communication wasn't the same. If you wanted to contact somebody, sure, you had the phone, but it was all letters. You had to write letters. You know, you wanted to do demo tapes, you know, and all this. There was no computers to help you out with that. You know, so artwork was more difficult. It was still a lot of money to release your own records.
Could you tell us a bit more, expand a bit when you talked about tax loss and big record companies?
Yeah, well,
meant by that.
Like I said, the problem is, I think, if you start that the reason that young people get into bands and stuff is because they like music first, and then they think, well, you know, it would be nice to be in a band myself, or I'm really into music, or I can play the guitar, I play the drums, or whatever, so they join a band. It's coloured, it's sort of definitely affected by their love of music. And therefore they think that the people who produce the records, or these days CDs or MP3s or whatever it is, they think that that they have the same kind of love, or the similar kind of love, but it's not, because they want to make money. It's a business, they're not a charity. So the musicians, the bands themselves, get into the wrong frame of mind in thinking, because you're very much sort of chaperoned and wined and dined and stuff by major record companies who because you're going to make them money, so they want to be nice to you, and they're your best friend, you know, and they'll talk about you, a problem with you've got with one of your neighbours or with whatever, you know, and talk about things that they wouldn't normally sort of be interested in at all. And so you get the wrong impression that these people care about you. And the awful thing is that all of a sudden you're cut off from the people, from the record company, from anything that they did for you or whatever. And the thing is that bands, they spend a lot of effort and a lot of time on rehearsing their music, going out and gigging it, sorting vans out, sorting PAs out. It costs a lot. They have to work a lot to do that. And then all of a sudden, a major record company comes along and they stop doing it because they just expect the record company to do it. And of course, this is when a lot of bands take a dive, because the record company is not going to do that. You're just one of probably a lot of bands that they've got, and a lot of bands are more successful than you.
This was the case at the time.
Yeah, yeah. I think we probably got a little complacent and a little sort of blinded by the getting sent to places like the manor, like I was saying, you know, these big posh studios cost a grand a day, you know, and you know, Martin Rushenton or anybody else in the business that we've involved in, they have a flair, they have charm, you know, that's why they're in the jobs they're in. And they'll name drop, like, all the time. Oh, yeah, like, for instance, I didn't realise, but we were having a meeting with Martin Rushenton in a pub one time, and I knew all these Mark Bolan jokes, and Mark Bolan had died, of course. I love T-Rex and love, you know, Mark Bolan's music, always did. And, I mean, this is sort of punky in some ways, you know, glammy, punky sort of thing before punk, like Bowie in some ways. But I was telling these jokes, and then I only find out later that he was a friend of Martin Rushenton. So in actual fact, I've sort of pissed the guy off without knowing. You know, his secretary, actually, Annie Roseberry, she was just a secretary at the time and generally dog's body for Martin Rushenton, but she actually became the head of A&R at CBS, I think it was, Epic. So, you know, here's the irony again. Years later, after the punk thing, 1986, my mother sees an advert in the Evening Chronicle in Newcastle. Would you like to be famous for 15 minutes? Hey, Tim, you should apply for this. You should do this. What it was they were offering local bands a chance to be on Channel 4 television to make a 15-minute film. But what you had to do was you had to give them a demo tape and you had to write a script for what you would do with a 15-minute film. They wouldn't allow the entries unless they had the written thing. So my mother convinced me and I did it. And I got one of the shows, famous for 15 minutes. Here's my chance. It was Jeff Wamfer was the producer who'd done stuff with the Eurythmics and everything and was high profile guy, Man Mountain. So they have all these parties. They had one in Glasgow, one in London, where all the people that are on the show go and you get all free drinks. You can stand at the bar all night drinking expensive lager and stuff, falling over. Don't have to do particularly much, just be there, and the show clips off the shows. Annie Roseberry walks in. Haven't seen her for 10 years. She walks up to me and she says, "What are you doing here?" You know, so these are the people that believed in us originally. Well, actually, I've got one of the films. But, you know, you're old news, you know. And then, 10 years later, she said, "You know, in retrospect, Neon could have been quite a successful band now." So these are the people that you're sort of dealing with. According to Martin Rushenton, in this sort of epilogue, he said that Neon had taken on too much of a sort of jazz rock approach to their music. The reason for that was because of the other guitarist that we got in, who was called Martin Holder. And Martin Holder had done a lot of sessions in London and played with John Stevens Away, which was very much a freeform jazz rock oriented thing. Martin went on and he joined Jar Wobble's band. You were talking about Factory Records before the interview. They used to play the Hacienda Club and stuff. And Jar Wobble, very, very interesting guy. In fact, another guy from Durham, Martin Atkins, who was in a club band in Durham at the time of the punk thing called Mind, he went for an audition for Pill and he got the job. He was in Pill for a long time. Martin was just another regular kid from around Durham, so miracles could happen. He reckoned that John Lydon was a lovely guy and nothing like the persona that was there. I've got an awful lot of respect for John Lydon. He still tells it like it is. Sometimes all you have to do is look at his record covers, you know.
So the media perception of punk at the time, how did you feel about that?
Well, we had champions of the whole thing who had quite influential positions. They lived in the Northeast, but they wrote for Sounds. Sounds no longer exists. It hasn't existed for quite a while, but it was an influential paper for punk. Phil Sutcliffe covered a lot of the gigs, and he, like John Peel, Phil Sutcliffe and Dick Godfrey was another guy. Ian Penman was another guy. They all ran a show from Radio Newcastle called Bedrock, which featured local bands. They had interviews where local bands could go in, and it was a centre of activity. It was in the old Radio Newcastle building, not where it is
BBC
now.
BBC Radio Newcastle,
yeah.
Can you just tell a bit more about the North East punk scene and how your experiences of that, and how you felt it evolved over a 3-year period of 76 to 79?
It was actually a short period of time, really, when you think about it. And then the record companies and the major press, the mainstream press, decided to dispense with it and started with a new slogan, which was New Wave. So
you mean dispense with the term punk?
Yeah. You know, it was no longer, that wasn't really what they wanted anymore, you know. And they'd already eaten up all of the small independent labels, you know. Most of them had gone into majors. I mean, this is the thing, when people talk about independent labels, a lot of them weren't independent. Eventually, they were just eaten and bought by the majors. So they called themselves independent, but they weren't independent. You know, they were still controlled. Their money was controlled by major record companies. And the bands that they could sign was controlled by major record companies. And then the independents, who'd started off with, you know, good intentions, eventually had to think about the money they were making. So even though they liked a band, they might not be able to sell enough records, so they couldn't sign them, you know. So it's hard to kind of describe the vibrancy that there was with the gigs. There was hundreds of gigs all over the place for during that period that you're talking about. It was very lucrative for selling beer. You could pack out small pubs and people would buy loads and loads of beer.
Is this the North East?
Yeah, the North East, yeah. Newcastle especially, Middlesbrough. I mean, we played many gigs in the Middlesbrough area, Teesside, Poly, Middlesbrough Town Hall, places like that, you know. I remember bands coming there. You know, the great thing about it was when bands who were more well known than we were, you'd get to support them. Like I talked about Susie and the Banshees or the Rich Kids, for instance. They were great. But like I remember playing with Penetration at the Red Car Courtin Bowl, and there was one gig with the Rich Kids, and they had a decibel meter. They could destroy bands. First chord when the Rich Kids came on stage, PA went off, lights went off, everything, you know, wrecked the performance. But they were still waiting, even though punk was there as the new thing, they were still waiting for the next thing. And that never really occurred. I mean, it kind of morphed in a new way, but then the new romantic movement came in and watered everything down. You know, in to a certain extent. I mean, there was still good stuff happening. You know, you'd get good labels that would bring out interesting stuff. But that edge, that three chord thing that you were talking about, had kind of gone, you know. And the whole thing was kind of exported to the States, like everything is anyway.
Had it not been imported from the States?
Well, anyway, I suppose, yeah, you could say that in a lot of ways. Yeah, a lot of those American bands, the Stooges and Iggy Pop and people like that, you know. That's name dropping, but I was actually in a place called Gnomis in London, which was a rehearsal studio, and Iggy Pop's band were rehearsing there, and Iggy Pop was there, and there was this long corridor to the sort of reception from where we were rehearsing, all rehearsal rooms all the way up the corridor. And I went out to go to the toilet, and I'm walking up the corridor and Iggy Pop's coming the other way. And I thought, that's Iggy Pop! You know, I love Iggy Pop.
What year was this?
This was later, I can't remember, turn of the decade, I suppose. And so I looked down at the ground, I'm walking on, and thought, that's Iggy Pop, I'll just walk past him. And Iggy Pop virtually bends down and goes, hiya! You know, so there you go, there's a real person, you know. And he was a lovely guy. So this is the thing, that's my prejudice and my feeling of, there I go again, you know, I'm in the hierarchy. Iggy Pop's much bigger than me, he's much more famous than me, so I'm not going to say hello to him, because you don't say hello to rock stars. But Iggy Pop was just there, ready to say hello to anybody, you know.
What do you account for the vibrancy of the 3-year period? Sort of the amount of bands and the amount of
gigs. This is the thing to try and put your finger on. Why? How did that occur? The only thing, I mean, you know, it's hard without getting esoteric about it, really. There was an energy that was about at that time. Now, if, for instance, if we weren't talking about punk, if we were talking about, say, use him as an example again, Steve Hillage. This is a very interesting thing. At the time of punk, Hillage was still playing. He was still playing the City Hall and things like this. And he said a very interesting thing in an interview with Phil Sutcliffe in 77. He said that, I've got a lot of things that I want to say, and it might involve politics, it might involve things about the society or whatever. But as soon as I'm labelled a hippie, all of the things that I might have to say that are relevant are out the window and nobody will listen to me. So this is where labels come into it. So, you know, but what Hillage was saying was that, in this interview with Phil Sutcliffe, was that it was an energy. You know, that we tuned into. I mean, the moon turns the tides. You know, so the earth goes through things. I don't want to say, you know, sound cosmic here. I'll put my bloody woolly hat on again. But there are times, you know, it's a sign of the times. And for some reason, it was that energy that made kids just play as loud and as fast and furiously as possible. But also, I think the society, and like you say, that the times... poverty, it's been said that a lot of good music, really good music, comes out of hard times. When people are all right, when they've got lots of money, when they're not struggling, that they're not, you know, they're not seeking to express themselves in the same kind of way. Desperation, in a way, you know, and it's like I was saying, I turned the corner when I was 16 and music gave me something that I can't explain in words, and it's still with me. I can't live without music. I feel as if I don't have an identity, like I'm nothing without the music. It's the only thing that's given me any self-respect. I was crap at everything else. You know what I mean? So I suppose that kids were motivated. The problem is, of course, you have the infiltration of the mainstream media and the music press and the gloss that they put on everything. So that... some people, I have absolutely no doubt, think we can make a lot of money out of this. There was a lot of promoters around Newcastle at the time that were out to make money. You know, they could hire halls, get a load of punk fans in, get a few bands on and make thousands of quid. It happened. You know, so some people's motivation was money. Record companies' motivation was money. So they manipulate and exploit the kids. Exploitation.
Why do you think it came and went so... Why do you think there was a... Why it was such a short period, this energy you described?
I think it was too much of a threat. I think that the powers that be don't like the established order to be. They'll let people, you know, if it's going to make some money for some of them, their pals, then they'll let it happen. You know, I mean, so they'll let it go to a certain extent. But if you really start putting your finger on things, then they're not going to allow that, you know. I mean, we think that we're talking about democracy and all of this, you know, while we're over in other countries killing their kids and stuff, you know. It's bullshit. The whole thing that they pass down from on high, the rules and the, you know, who would want to escape from a prison when they don't even realize that they're living in one? You know, so the last thing that we have to understand is the prison. You know, there are far more easier ways for the establishment to make money out of music than people who are causing disruption and taking the piss. I mean, the Pistols took the piss out of the whole thing, you know, that whole thing with A&M records and everything. You know, they were getting loads of money and then it became too dodgy to even release their records. Interesting as well, I heard an interview recently. They were talking about Malcolm McLaren and the Pistols. Malcolm McLaren couldn't stay in the room with the Pistols on their own. He was too afraid of them to stand in the room. Apparently, John Lydon could knock people against the wall just by looking at them. The guy had that kind of power, you know. I mean, he's very cantankerous and he can be very, you know, he's still got that kind of, I don't know, that weird thing that gets up people's nose, you know. But at the same time, he knows how to win an argument. The guy is very, very astute, you know.